the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. The greatest choreographer of the 1930s was Busby Berkeley. Using dozens of elaborately costumed women, filmed with crane shots from above, Berkeley created surreal Rorschach imagery, living fountains, and sculpture. He took control of the eye of the viewer and moved the movie musical from a New York stage-bound work to an unbridled Hollywood cinematic art. My guest, Jeffrey Spivak, is the author of a new book about this extraordinary artist. The book is called Buzz, The Life and Art of Busby Berkeley. Jeffrey Spivak, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
My favorite Busby Berkeley film is Footlight Parade. Do you think that's his masterpiece?
It contains one of his numbers that I consider one of his three masterpieces, if I can get specific. The film itself is a load of fun with Jimmy Cagney, but Berkeley did not direct the entire film, only the musical numbers for Footlight Parade. But By a Waterfall, that appears in the film toward the end, is the greatest aquacade, I believe, ever filmed.
It's bizarre.
Yes.
I especially love this shot that's under their legs, the women's legs, their spread legs, and there's another girl swims underneath. It's about a half a second shot, but it's so great.
It's absolutely brilliant. I know what you're referring to, and I saw it with an audience last year in Chicago, where I'm from, on screen, and they all applauded the minute that little sequence came up.
And this also has some unintentionally comic sequences in it, like, for instance, Ruby Keeler comes popping out of the water with a smile on her face, but she looks very awkward.
If you only knew how long those poor girls waited in that water. I mean, it looks glamorous in Hollywood, but the reality is, you know, Berkeley would often create on the set. So those girls would be standing in place and their skin wrinkling up like a prune. While Berkeley is walking around, it's quiet. All you hear is the pumps moving. There's no music, nothing fancy. And so, yes, he got some funny performances. And Ruby Keeler, you know, can you imagine if there was a lot of chlorine in the water? She looked a little uncomfortable. And she really was. She really was not a swimmer. She was a dancer. But she followed the lead of Busby Berkeley.
Now, so let me just ask you about that From the Waterfall number, just to get our conversation off. Did they film it in a gigantic tank at Warner Brothers or something?
They absolutely did. A gigantic pool was set up, and of course their art department set up the kind of slides that Berkeley suggested. See, this was not Berkeley's first musical number in the water. He did that with a film called The Kid from Spain, starring Eddie Cantor.
That's Eddie Cantor?
Yeah, he made some Eddie Cantor pictures before he went to Warner Brothers in 42nd Street. So in The Kid from Spain, the film begins with a water number, but it's just a prelude to the kind of water number that's featured in Footlight Parade.
Was the water warm or freezing cold?
You would assume it was at room temperature over a while, but I don't know if it really was a heated pool or not. So
the agony of doing all that in cold water must have been really horrible.
I mean, if you see the length of the number, runs about 10 minutes. So if you can imagine Berkeley, the way he worked, he didn't shoot with multiple cameras. He shot with one camera, got the shot he wanted, then moved on to the next setup, got his little snippet, and then on to the next. So that was literally put together shot by shot, almost completely edited within the camera.
There's a whippoorwill that's calling you. By a waterfall, he's dreaming too.
There's a magic melody Mother Nature sings to me.
So you're saying that Busby Berkeley worked in a almost improvisational way, that he didn't block out absolutely everything before shooting?
Absolutely. Many times journalists would come to the set to see his method, and Berkeley would tell them, take a look all you want, but there's no method here. He improvised usually on the spot. And if it wasn't improvised on the sound stage, he was known to improvise in his own bathtub with a martini by his side.
Well, now you cite By a Waterfall as one of three masterworks by Busby Berkeley. So what are the others? Lullaby of Broadway, is that one?
That would be it, absolutely, Lullaby of Broadway. I got to hear that beat from a much later film. That's the one with Ann Miller from the film Small Town Girl, where she's dancing around what looks like disembodied arms playing musical instruments. It's featured in the film That's Entertainment.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
That musical sequence where she's spinning around, all these arms sticking up through the floor. That's later Berkeley, but I consider that one of his masterpieces, as well as probably the musical numbers, all of them featured in the film The Gang Is All Here. I mean, that was probably the most audacious of any film Berkeley worked on, and in this particular one, he directed the full thing and the musical numbers. And if you haven't seen Carmen Miranda and the girl and the lady in the Tutti Frutti hat on the big screen, you're really missing something.
And now, that's the one that has heads flying at the end, the sort of heads are flying at you?
Yes, it's something about Berkeley and disembodied body parts is interesting. Yes, at the climax of the number, at the very end, the polka dot polka, it goes right into a reprise of A Journey to a Star, and yes, all the heads of all the cast members pop into the screen and sing their little part, and that's the way the film ends. It's just audacious from start to finish.
Now, Jeffrey Spivak, you just mentioned seeing some of these films on the big screen, and I know that you're going to be signing copies of Buzz, The Life and Art of Busby Berkeley, in San Francisco at the Great Castro Theater, and that's coming up soon?
Yes, it's coming up on both February 10th and 11th. They're going to be showing a different double feature each day. The classic Berkeley from the Warner Brothers years. They're showing 42nd Street, Footlight Parade, Dames, and Gold Diggers of 1933. And to see them on the big screen, I don't care what type of high-definition setup you may have in your home. These films were not made for anything but the silver screen, and the Castro Theater is just made for these kind of films. And I am so thrilled to go. I've seen these films, as you can well imagine, many, many times, especially in writing the book. But I am so excited to see them on the big screen, and it's just a thrill for me to be out there, and I'd be happy to sign and personalize copies of the book for anyone who shows up.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the cinematography in Busby Berkeley's films. Now, you mentioned The Gang's All Here a minute ago, and that one is in Technicolor. But most of his Warner Brothers, all of his Warner Brothers films were in black and white. Did he like black and white cinematography? Did he use black and white cinematography well?
Well, the second question, absolutely. I mean, the proof is in the actual film result. But I don't know if it's a matter of liking or not liking. I mean, all his films were in black and white, except for some of the later pictures, when color was just the studio standard at that point. But yes, I mean, that was the Warner Brothers house style. You know, Warner Brothers had their own style. They call it the house style, like MGM had theirs and Paramount had theirs. Warner Brothers back then, in those days when Berkeley got started, was, you know, the home of the gritty picture, you know, the stories ripped out of today's headlines, the gangster picture. It's so evident that house style is carried over in Berkeley's first film with Warner Brothers, 42nd Street. That's a tough, gritty backstage story, and the fact is they were going to release it as a straight drama because musicals had fallen out of favor, and then Berkeley's numbers were added to the picture and they could not be denied, and that set him on the path of success. But yes, whether black and white or color, I mean, Buzz worked conveniently with both. And actually, his first real dabble in Technicolor was his first film. It's two-strip Technicolor in the film Whoopi, 1930, his first picture.
And that's the Eddie Cantor picture.
That's correct.
Well, you know, you mentioned 42nd Street, and that movie is very unusual because it's the only musical of that era to be a drama.
Yes, and actually, musicals were really out of favor by 1932. You know, musicals were actually is the only genre in cinema that was given birth by sound. There were no musical pictures before then.
Right.
And so they were readily acceptable when they first came out, 1928, 1929. all singing, all dancing, but they were not very exciting to watch. I mean, you do get to hear them singing, and the camera would pretty much be stationary, and the chubby chorus girls would dance from side to side and then move off stage. And even Berkeley, back then, you know, he had to be talked into coming to Hollywood because he was a very well-regarded Broadway director. He didn't like the way they did musicals back then. And so they had fallen out of favor, and in fact, it got to the point where many theater owners would post a sign out in front of their theater saying, "Our current presentation is not a musical." Specifically. So Warner Brothers was taking a real gamble then, and of course they were almost in receivership. The company had fallen on hard times due to the Depression and had almost declared themselves bankrupt, but the success of 42nd Street and then the Gold Diggers of 1933 reinvigorated the studio and their profits, and Berkeley was on his way. So he'd worked in color and black and white, but it just, well, he didn't profess any preference to either one.
There's a certain visual artist quality to what Busby Berkeley created in the 1930s. Were there influences from the visual arts, and, you know, Art Deco or Dadaism, or, you know, what were his influences?
The standard word on Berkeley before I wrote the book was that he arranged these military drills, thousands of men, and that's how he got to do thousands of chorus girls. And that is only partially true. Berkeley's aesthetic really came from his years doing Broadway. He was an actor at first, but eventually got into directing Broadway shows and some of the big shows back then. Of course, in Berkeley's days in the 20s, the Flo Ziegfeld kind of spectacle was big. And Berkeley worked on something similar to that called the Earl Carroll Vanities. A big showgirl, lots of women on the stage, gigantic props, larger than normal life props, the use of mirrors to give an interesting perspective on what's going on in the stage. And the critics of Broadway shows in those days took notice of the unusual stagings of this man named Busby Berkeley. So he really got his, you know, his feel for the kind of look that he presented from the Broadway years. There was some of that in the military. Yes, he did do some YMCA shows that toured through Europe when he was there during World War I. But the fact is, it was his stage years that set him on the path of working in motion pictures. And then he was such a novice. When he was told the reality of what the camera could do, at that point, his aesthetic was born in the cinematography language. He used a single camera exclusively for all his pictures, never a multiple camera setup, just as I described before. And it's so austere, he gave credit to no one. He never said there were any influences. And by the way, if you say the word choreographer, Busby Berkeley would bristle at the term because he was anything but a choreographer. To him, choreographers started with the likes of Agnes DeMille. Buzz was a dance director. A choreographer teaches the rudimentary steps of the dance that's going to be presented. And every studio had their own dance people that went in and worked with the actresses. Buzz didn't design dances. He dance directed for motion pictures. And that is different. And in fact, in the older days of Hollywood, we know the Academy Award nominations just came out. Well, in Berkeley's day, they actually had a category for dance direction. And that's something they don't have anymore.
Huh. Did he win?
He never won. A bridesmaid, never a bride. And for that very reason, I put in the epilogue of the book that I believe nothing would be more fair than awarding Busby Berkeley a posthumous Oscar. This man saved the studio, gave work in the Depression to his friends, and redefined an art form. And the fact that he doesn't have an Academy Award is, in small way, a crime.
We're talking with Jeffrey Spivak, and he's the author of a new book about Busby Berkeley called Buzz, The Life and Art of Busby Berkeley. Well, Busby Berkeley's films had a huge revival in the 1960s, and I think that's in no small part due to the rise of recreational drug use. But
no, actually, that might have occurred while watching those films, but in the 1960s there was a general nostalgia boom. And Berkeley was revitalized. He went to many film festivals. He was feted at the Chicago Film Festival and San Francisco. And in the late 60s, the midnight movies on college campuses and in big cities, they weren't horror films and they weren't adult films. They were those Warner Brothers films from the 1930s. So the resurgence of Berkeley in the 60s, I think, was a part of a general nostalgia boom, and the fact that Berkeley's name was out there in public again to a new generation that had never heard of him.
And I think that in turn inspired the Broadway show Dames at Sea, which was kind of a Busby Berkeley-esque show. And then, of course, Ruby Keeler came back and was on Broadway at that time, too, doing No, No, Nanette.
You were absolutely right about the Dames at Sea. Yes, it was a pastiche of the Berkeley numbers. And No, No, Nanette was a 1925 production that was being brought up again by producer Harry Rigby. He loved the films of Busby Berkeley, and he contacted Buzz and asked him if he wouldn't like to be part of the production. In other words, his credit would be production entirely supervised by Busby Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
Berkeley called Ruby Keeler, who had been out of the business for quite a while. She was a recent widow. She knew that Buzz had always dreamed of one more show and one more opening, and she agreed to star in No, No, Nanette as well. So here was Busby Berkeley back on Broadway for the first time in over 40 years, and Ruby Keeler in a classic show that had songs like Tea for Two associated with it. It was a monstrous hit on Broadway, and it played big and out of town cities as well.
Yeah.
Fact of the matter is, Berkeley was no more than a figurehead to the entire production. Used for his name value alone, he did almost nothing because the other producer involved didn't like him and thought he was a relic. And he lost his percentage points in the show. His billing was cut to almost nothing. It was directed by somebody else and choreographed by somebody else. Berkeley had almost nothing to do with it, but he was used for name recognition alone, and he was interviewed many times in the New York press. And here's Busby Berkeley back at work again, and you see him sitting, you know, in the front row looking at some of the girls doing their auditions. But the fact of the matter is he had nothing to do, and it was a very, very sad state of affairs for a show that did that well. And I recount the entire story in the chapter called The Figurehead in the book.
Well, it's kind of a sad story.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you about Busby Berkeley's view of women. I mean, in most of his musical numbers, there's always, you know, a little bit of dancing, and Ruby Keeler does some tap dancing and so forth. But mostly it's manipulating women into creating these visuals, whether from above or below or whatever. Did he have what kind of a regard did he have for women dancers?
Well, like any red-blooded American, he loved them. He was married six times, and that's another story for another show. But he loved his girls. He used a lot of the same women in many of his films. He called them his close-up girls. One thing that he invented a couple of things, but the one thing he's most proud of, and you can see it in his very first film, he used close-ups of the girls, their faces, up close, one after the other in sequence, like falling dominoes, one face, then a next, then a next. Every film, even the By the Waterfall number, you see them coming out of the water one at a time. He loved his girls and paid them great respect and got them contracts. And again, it's something, there's no question. I think he was much tougher on the male actors, especially people like Dick Powell, than he ever was with Ruby Keeler. I mean, look at his numbers. They are practically love letters to the Berkeley girls. And he was always looking for the next one. He was part of all the auditions for all the studios he worked for. They relied on his judgment. And if you say, how did Berkeley view his girls? I'd say with the utmost respect and admiration.
We're talking with Jeffrey Spivak, and his book is called Buzz, The Life and Art of Busby Berkeley. Well, after redefining the musical, or defining it possibly, at Warner Brothers, Busby Berkeley came to MGM and did some great pictures there, including Girl Crazy, right? That was one of his?
Well, Girl Crazy was one of the last he did. He went to MGM, first of all, surprisingly, and a lot of people don't know this. He went to MGM and he directed the If I Only Had a Brain number from The Wizard of Oz.
Huh.
It was a longer number that you see now. It was about 5 minutes in length, and it was wildly inventive, with the scarecrow spinning like a whirling dervish, bouncing from fence post to fence post, flying in the air, coming down again. So fantastic that Victor Fleming saw the rushes, saw what Berkeley had done, and wrote to Buzz and said, Buzz, you should have directed the whole picture.
Sure.
But they took that number, used a couple of different takes, and put together the final number that we see today. And let me tell you, I love The Wizard of Oz, like everyone does, but I sure wouldn't mind seeing a Busby Berkeley version of that same film from start to finish.
Do the outtakes exist?
Well, the number itself, the If I Only Had a Brain, is featured as an extra on all the latest releases of The Wizard of Oz on DVD. Oh. So you can find it.
Oh, good.
And, that was his first test at MGM, but he really hit the water big time with the biggest stars of the day, Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. They paired them together a couple times before, but never for a musical. Berkeley's first film for MGM, which he was both director and dance director, was Babes in Arms, released the same year as The Wizard of Oz, 1939, but made appreciably more money than that film did.
Huh.
Mickey Rooney, for his part, got an Academy Award nomination for the film.
Right.
It's absolutely terrific film. It's unlike the Warner Brothers pictures. The days with the chorus girls were seemingly behind Berkeley. Of course, he came back to it in The Gang's All Here. But in 1939, he had new bosses. It was a new studio. They didn't make pictures like those gold digger pictures, which is fine because they had practically fallen out of favor by 1939 anyway. So Berkeley was, he never complained. He didn't miss, you know, being 60 feet up in the air. He still took a top shot or a high shot when necessary, but he worked in a different format here at MGM and did a masterful job. The film was so successful, it launched two more sequels, Strike Up the Man, Babes on Broadway, and Berkeley finally ended that run with the Mickey Judy pictures with Girl Crazy, but only for one number, the I Got Rhythm number that's shown at the end of the picture.
Which has really got a lot of his trademark, you know, you were talking about the domino effect, in this case with dancers and musicians.
Oh, yes. You know, that kind of stuff was carried over somewhat. But if you ever see the actual title number in Babes in Arms, the Babes in Arms number,
right.
It's almost like a small riot is taking place in the town.
So they're marching down the street.
Yes, and they're marching. Berkeley captures it beautifully with very, it seems like it's a long take, but it's actually a couple of takes butted together. But it's really brilliantly designed with an explosive ending with many things going on in the frame. It's just terrific. Like I said, he worked for a different studio, but it was in no way did it cramp his style. In fact, it allowed him to experiment and go to other areas. And in fact, his favorite of all of his feature films that he directed was done at MGM in 1942 with For Me and My Gal, the first film.
Gene Kelly.
of Gene Kelly and Judy Garland, and that was Berkeley's favorite of all the films he did. It was not his Gold Digger Pictures at Warner Brothers.
And now that's a Technicolor picture, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, it's black and white.
Oh, black and white. Oh, well.
For me and my gals, black and white. Uh-huh. Yeah, the first big Technicolor was The Gang's All Here in 1943.
Uh-huh. That was at 20th Century Fox?
Right, yeah. He went to Fox then, as directors sometimes do. They get bought for a certain project. And back then, it's a whole story. Why 20th Century Fox? Why in that year? To shorten it up, basically, Daryl Zanuck had now, who was Berkeley's champion back in the Warner Brothers days, now ran 20th Century Fox. He got Buzz on board. And back then, in 1943, after Pearl Harbor, the Asian markets were pretty much closed to the studios. So were the European markets in the height of the war. But there was one great emerging market that 20th Century Fox particularly capitalized on, and that was the country of Brazil.
Mm.
They loved films like That Night in Rio that we were sending to them, and in turn, they sent us their two greatest exports, Bananas and Carmen Miranda. So it was based on that the film The Gang's All Here is very much Latin-themed in many of the numbers, and it was a big hit. Big Technicolor, which was the 20th Century Fox style as well, so all their musicals had to be filmed in Technicolor, and so that's how he got to work for there. It was a one-picture deal, and then he went on and did other things.
Well, when did things kind of dry up for him? I mean, he did not work throughout the 1950s and 60s, right?
That is true. In fact, his career stalled a couple of times. Most sadly, in the mid-1940s, when his mother had passed away. His mother is a key element of the book. Buzz was extremely devoted to her, to the detriment of some of his marriages. When she passed away in 1946, he was already out of work for almost a year. A film he had directed hadn't even been released, and they were holding it back. Money wasn't coming in. And he had alimonies to pay and mortgages to pay. He spent cavalierly when he had the money, but the money wasn't there any longer. And when his mother died, he tried to commit suicide, which put him out of action for almost a couple of years. He came back slowly, did some terrific work in the late 40s and early 50s, such as the Ann Miller number that I mentioned. It kind of slowed down again through all of the 50s. He did a little television work, but really nothing. It was a shame, a man of his power, doing nothing, saddled with nothing. He was back working again for the film Jumbo, with Doris Day in 1962.
Yeah.
That was his last screen credit, as a technician. He did make an appearance in a lousy Warner Brothers film in the late 60s that was released for a week and then withdrawn, called The Sphinx. But for Berkeley, working on a picture, 1962 was the last, and he passed away in 1976.
Well, I guess we have a chance to see the great Busby Berkeley in his prime when you will be at the Castro Theater on February 10th and 11th, showing a couple of double bills. The book is called Buzz, The Life and Art of Busby Berkeley, the author, Jeffrey Spivak. Thank you so much for spending some time on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at kusp.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank Jeffrey Spivak for being my guest. His book is called Buzz, The Life and Art of Busby Berkeley. I also want to thank, of course, our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Ms. Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Without you, there'd be no From the Bookshelf, Breanne. So thanks. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.